The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I meet director Carol Morley and actress Zowie Ashton to talk about their creative collaboration in bringing a forgotten life to the big screen in Dreams of a Life. And we've an awards roundup as Zan Brooks and I recuperate from a whirlwind weekend in Berlin for the European Film Awards and a night out closer to home at the British Independent Film Awards, announced last week. And Zan and myself will of course be reviewing some of the week's big releases, including Antonio Banderas with Whiskers and a Tail in Puss in Boots, French actor Daniel Auteuil in The Well Digger's Daughter, and the high-concept US indie drama Another Earth. Yes, it's the best film podcast on this planet, at least. It's Film Weekly.
I worked at the paper for 10 years and there wasn't a story like it. There was such a remarkable lack of information about Joyce Vincent, it was so hard to find anything about her.
Back in 2003 in London, newspapers reported briefly on the discovery of human remains in a London flat in Wood Green Shopping City, no less. The woman had been dead for 3 years, and although what was left was a skeleton, it was noted that both her heating and her television were still on. That woman, it turned out, was Joyce Carol Vincent, and her story is the subject of a new documentary, Dreams of a Life, by director Carol Morley. The film is a forensic look at who Joyce was, how she lived her life, why she died, and more importantly, how the death of someone so vibrant could go unnoticed for 3 years. To tell me more about the film, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by director Carol Morley and the actress Zowie Ashton, who plays Joyce in the reimagining of that life. Welcome to Film Weekly, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in. And thank you so much for your film as well, which is quite moving, it's quite disturbing, it's quite beautiful in parts as well. Carol, you picked up on the story of what happened to Joyce Carol Vincent. Did you think it was a macabre story when you first heard it? What did you envisage you would do with it?
I knew that I didn't want somebody to become just that anonymous headline. So I don't like to make films that are really miserable. So I would never have made a miserable film. But then when I started finding out about Joyce, people were like, she had a wicked sense of humour. So I knew it was really important to imbue it with life, and you know, and people said she lit up a room. So for me, I didn't really want to concentrate on the ending, which was the 3 years she was forgotten. I wanted to bring her to life and really look at what that life was, and that Joyce didn't remain in the margins, you know, that you know I brought her into everybody's perspective, really.
Presumably you had no idea quite how interesting a life that she had or wanted for herself when you first read about her disappearance or her
non-appearance. I mean, she could have been somebody that just stayed in the library for years, you know, but that could be interesting too, you know. So I just felt that anybody's life deserves more than a kind of grim headline, I think. So that was the starting point. But of course, as a filmmaker and finding stuff out about her, I was obsessed, let's face it. I was completely obsessed.
But it's an act of journalism. Yeah. It's an act of filmmaking as well. I'm intrigued as to when you decided, right, I'm going to flesh this woman out. I'm going to get an actress to actually play her. Because what I like about the documentary is that it's sort of a documentary. It plays with form. I don't really know what sort of film it is, really. I don't know what category it is. In fact, as chairman of the Film Critics Circle at the moment, people are debating, is it a doc? Where do we put it? Is it a drama? I don't quite know what to do with it. I think we're going doc in the end.
Yes.
Because there is journalism at its core. But you've got an actress there playing the part, and that's Zowie Ashton. When did you decide that that's what you needed?
Well, I think the kind of films I like to make and I'm interested in making are, I just call them films. So I don't think of myself as a journalist or a documentary filmmaker or anything. I just think filmmaker with a big F. And that my responsibility is to, in the end, to bring an audience a story that can be told in the most compelling way possible. And I think with this story, it was really important to have the real testimonies. But also it was really important to bring Joyce to life. And, you know, Zowie, wow, you know, meeting Zowie and that feeling when she came in the room that I was meeting Joyce. I mean, it's been quite strange. But so for me, it was about the testimonies and a kind of link to the real and the fact that Joyce really did exist. And this isn't made up and this isn't, you know, a work of fiction. But on the other hand, film is so beautiful at you know, creating feeling and emotion. Yeah. And
well, I think you do all the things that film can do in your film. So you're right, it is a film because you've got drama, you've got music, you've got sense in there, you've got horror at the heart as well. Zowie, when you went for an audition, did you know who you would be playing, what sort of part it was, who Joyce Carol Vincent was, who Carol Morley was even?
I literally found everything out in one big sort of whack when I got the script and the research that Carol had done and the headline all sort of through, you know, as you do as an actor waiting for the next part and you get all the stuff through and you're sifting through it and you're like, oh yeah, this is okay. And it was just like my head, it had exploded, you know.
What was it that really chimed with you?
I think first of all, I'm from Stoke Newington and I couldn't believe as a woman at that time living on my own, I was reading this article that hadn't made it sort of 20 minutes up the road, you know, from Wood Green to where I was. Yeah. I was stunned, actually.
It's Wood Green Shopping City that she's in. That's what's in the film. It's Wood Green Shopping City up there. I've been to that store underneath it.
Who hasn't? If you're a teenager in, you know, living in Stoke Newington or Hackney thereabouts, that is your West End. That is where you go, you know, and instantly all of these sort of pictures of it sort of popped up in my mind. I just thought, no, how can this be? And then this whole thing of that sort of imagined memory thing, you know,
that
you
do. Did it occur to you that you might have actually been to Wood Green City while Joyce, because it was 3 years she was lying in that flat decomposing, you might have been there while that was happening?
I mean, that sense of logic didn't even touch.
I don't want to scare you.
Down. No, I know. Oh, no, I'm thinking about it. No, that sense of logic didn't even apply at that time. I began to think, have I heard about this story? I sort of began to mesh maybe lots of different little bits of headlines together. And anyway, I was just determined to know more. And straight away then reading Carol's script, which, you know, the isn't a massive amount of dialogue if you've seen the film, but just these gorgeous moments. Mm.
It's interesting for you as well because we all know you're playing a dead person in a way, yeah. But when you're playing her while she was alive, she has no idea that she would be dead. Do you want to imbue her with some kind of sense of doom, or was it important for you, Carol, to sort of say, Zowie, you're playing her very much alive in this spiritual person that lit up a room, this kind of very vibrant person?
Yeah, I didn't let Zowie see any of the testimonies that...
So all those talking heads, she had no idea what
people were talking
about.
She never saw them, because I felt that, you know, in a way, that's the kind of thing that happens when you're dead, that people, you know, create an obituary for you. So I didn't really want to see Zowie see Joyce's obituary, if you like. So I wanted Zowie to sort of get factual ideas. And obviously I wrote a script that was quite visual, wasn't it? And because I felt in a way all the testimonies were, you know, the words that you needed. And then I think that, I mean, you know, there are words in it, because I like that idea of that, you know, often documentary can use kind of, you know, illustrative reconstruction and people don't talk and it's all, I really hate that. Mm. Anyway.
Words that there were so amazingly chosen and just spoke volumes with so little.
It's called Dreams of a Life, not Dreams of a Death, for example.
Exactly.
So it is about the excitement that life can be and the hole that we make in people's lives and then we can disappear. That's the frightening thing, that we can actually fall down the back of a sofa like a lost penny.
Yeah, I mean, I think the people that have seen it so far and the kind of reactions I'm getting, people, you know, while at the same time sort of really feeling for Joyce and kind of the circumstances of her being forgotten, they really are thinking of their own lives and their friends and their, you know, family and people they know. And I think it's sort of really resonated with people, this kind of, God, how close are we really to that? And I think, you know, the sense of security we get in the world, I mean, where does it come from anyway? And what does it mean? I mean, I don't know. So I was interested in that, but not in being unseemly and wallowing in some kind of, oh, isn't it dark? Isn't it, ooh, you know, I hate all that. So I really wanted to go, look, it's a really extreme headline, but here we go towards somebody that you would have wanted to know, and maybe we know somebody like that, or we are that person.
I almost think I might have met her at some point. I mean, given that she was in North London, she kind of moved around. She seemed to have touched every, you know, been in so many different corners of London. She was in the music scene. She met Captain Sensible and Gil Scott Heron. Yeah. She had great taste. She was a good singer. She kind of had a Sade like kind of thing. You mentioned that the mark that we make, and she might think that she made sort of no mark, but talking to the people that you talked to, particularly her ex-boyfriend Martin. In a way, he becomes a sort of star of the film because it's a film about, damn, I should have done something.
Yeah.
He should have, you know, you think, well, why didn't you kind of confess that you loved her and you guys should have been together, and then we wouldn't be here talking about this lost life.
I mean, it's that thing, isn't it? In retrospect, you know, we could all have done different things. And I think that's the thing too, that sense of regret, of longing, of what we could have done, what we should have done, what we wish now we'd done, but we don't. And I mean, and I think even now, I think, you know, when I'm going about my daily life, I really probably it'd be better if I did that, but I can't quite bring myself to do it. and I think that in a way that, you know, I think in a way the film is provoking people to kind of phone people and do all that. But maybe some people want to be anonymous, you know. So I didn't want to make a film that goes, God, you should all get married because then people will notice you, or we should all, like, you know, have parties with our neighbours, although some people are doing that. But I think in a way I didn't want to make a film that moralised or told you how to live, but at least made people think about their lives and what it was, and, you know.
The mystery that is, I mean, there she is lying on her sofa when they discover her Christmas presents. Did we ever find out? And that's the big mystery. Who are the Christmas presents for? Did we ever find that out?
You don't find out in the film.
No.
And I never found out in real life because all the contents of Joyce's flat were destroyed due to contamination because of the body decomposition. So the only way is if they're in the police records, which I never managed to get under the Freedom
Someone
of Information.
Should be having, after this film, you're going to want presents. I'm just reading Julian Barnes' book called Sense of an Ending. It's about him receiving in a will from a dead person from many 40 years ago, getting that back. And in a sense, that what makes yours, I think, a documentary, in a sense that documentaries have a life beyond the film themselves. There's more story even to this dead person. And so you bring her to life. I love the scenes of you singing.
Thank
I think
you.
There we see her dream. We all sing in the bathroom or in front of the mirror at some point. And it's about where we're dreaming at that point. We're dreaming ourselves on stage, you know, having a hit record, and you're doing Betty Wright. It is a beautiful, beautiful kind of moment. I may appear to evergreen, turned upside down. Is that something that you wanted to do? Is that something that Carol foisted upon you? Do you sing in the bathroom at night? And if so, what?
I sing in the bathroom all the time. I hope my neighbours don't hear. No, I was really belting it out this morning, actually. Fleetwood Mac this morning.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, at least they know you're there. Do you know what I mean?
At least they know I'm there.
Yeah.
I mean, the music scape of the film, there were so many, there was a sort of a visual landscape that Carol created for me when we came together on the project. And obviously, you know, almost like a timeline, you know, a whole timeline of this woman's life. And that was punctuated with music.
We hear about her family, her sisters, exactly, who don't appear in your film. And I think your film mentions the fact that there are many more people who knew Joyce but didn't want to come forward. As a result of the film being well received, the film being liked, and Zowie playing her so likably and lovably, have you had people offer you more information about Joyce than we get?
You know, you have to make decisions about a film, and there's only so much you can put in it. And I think because of the family not agreeing to be in it, it became a very different film, and really a film about friendship and about relationships. So I'm really pleased about that. But I always promised the family I would screen the film for them before the public saw it. In a way, some of the people that didn't want to be in it, I think it was because they felt by association with the story that they would somehow look bad. There was also the fiancé at the end that I did find, who I think possibly would have looked bad. So I wanted to make a film about consent, because I could have gone and knocked on people's door and done a panorama type thing. But I wanted to make a beautiful legacy and not some kind of, let's blame someone, let's find people, let's put people on camera that don't want to be on camera. It's like, what's the point of that? You know, so it is a film of consent, which I'm really
pleased
about.
Given it's a film about someone who did want to.
Yeah,
consent, I think, is a massive part of when you're just saying about meeting people afterwards and seeing them, because you do...
Yeah.
you know, if you play a fictional character, if you make a more fictional film, you don't really have to stand up next to it as much as you have to. And and I'm very, very happy to. And thankfully, the people that are in the film and the real people from Joyce's life have consented. And I know I speak for Carol as well when I say that's just like the gem in a very beautiful crown.
It is. It's a gem of a film. This is one of my favourites of the year. I'm going to be doing that next week. But it feature again. So that's why I got you in, because I couldn't have you on the same show. But it is. I thought it was a wonderful, wonderful piece of work. And I think a cool piece of work, because I don't know, as I say, quite where to put it. But it's a wonderful performance. Carol, brilliant documentary, filmmaking. It is brilliant. It's Dreams of a Life. And thank you so much, Carol Morley and Zoe Ashton, for coming in.
Thank you.
Carol Morley's Dreams of a Life goes on release here in the UK on Friday, the 16th of December. Very much alive and nowhere near Wood Green, Guardian film critic Zan Brooks joins me. Welcome, Zan.
Thanks, Jess.
Nice to see you. We were in Berlin this weekend.
We were, by the wall.
Yeah, much of that we will discuss later, but we will review this week Another Earth. I shall also tell you about The Well Digger's Daughter. You can tell me about Puss in Boots, if you would, please. And we shall come together to review New Year's Eve as well. So let's start with Another Earth, a high-concept, low-budget drama. Here's Rhoda, played by Britt Marling, announcing she sent an essay in and wants to take a shuttle to Earth 2.
Did you hear about that contest?
Mm.
The shuttle to Earth 2?
Mm.
I submitted an essay.
You did.
It's silly.
You'd go?
Yes.
You don't know what's out there.
That's why I would go.
Now, what on earth is she on about?
There is a parallel earth full of parallel Rhodas and you and me that is up in the sky. And everyone's very excited about this, including Rhoda, who is so busy watching it that she causes a fatal car accident, which is the sort of trigger mechanism for this story, which winds up with her being the cleaner of the widower who survived the accident, played by William Mapother.
So she wipes out his family because she's looking at a distant star.
Yeah.
And 4 years later, she turns up to clean his house.
Yeah, without him knowing who she is.
Yeah, she knows who he is.
Yeah.
And she, he doesn't.
Well,
know
she goes to confess and then chickens out. And then they fall into this kind of strange relationship that then becomes romantic, even though he doesn't know actually who she is.
Yeah, and all this time, the other Earth.
The other Earth is coming.
Getting nearer and nearer in a melancholia kind of way.
Exactly.
Okay. What a lot of rubbish. I just thought this was absolute bobbins from the word go.
It's certainly overpraised, shall we say. I think this was at Sundance and got everybody very, very excited.
I think young Americans seem to like this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I think I hate to use the word pretentious because I think it's an overused word to kind of dismiss a lot of very ambitious, audacious work. But this certainly felt ponderous, and it felt like a small film taking on big issues, but not quite incorporating them. So it did feel a little bit clunky, and the acting was a little bit off note
but
sometimes.
But it's a big, big concept. Absolutely. Okay, there's another Earth where everything there is replicated.
Yeah.
So what, it's a second chance saloon?
Well, I think that's it. I mean, all sci-fi is allegory and metaphor. And in this case, the metaphor is very much to the front and a little bit crude. So yeah, it's the last chance saloon. It's the chance of an alternative reality, maybe a happier life than the one that we're leading on this Earth.
And so maybe his family didn't get wiped out on that Earth?
Maybe not. And maybe she didn't cause the car crash and went on to have a happier life than she's had.
Yeah, and maybe she wasn't born.
Maybe,
and maybe
she wasn't
you
born.
And I are there giving this a good review.
Maybe we are. Maybe we look a lot better than we do.
But, I mean, it was ponderous, it was dim, the dialogue was heavy. She was a terrible actress.
She co-wrote it, didn't she?
Is she? Britt Marling.
Britt Marling.
What
I'm
is
not
Britt
sure.
Marling?
I remember there was a film out last week called The Girl with the Yellow Boots.
Yeah.
That again starred the co-writer. And it feels like a sort of vanity trip, particularly if they're not muscular enough actors to kind of carry it.
I just thought, I sort of hated every single second of this.
I didn't hate the last bit. I thought that the last scene, the last shot was very nice.
Did you?
Without giving too much away.
That is giving a bit away.
No, it's not. No, it's not. It could be anything.
No, that's what I'm saying.
It could have been a cow. Could have been a cow walking in a field. I thought it was great.
Do you think it all comes together at that point? For me, it just never worked.
No, I think it was a little last-minute reprieve that kind of ensured that it ended on an uplift.
Yeah.
And so
it's a happy ending of melancholia, let's put it that way.
Yeah, exactly. I walked out of the cinema for 30 seconds thinking, actually, no, it wasn't too bad. And then I thought, oh, yeah, but all the stuff that went before it was clanky and a little bit trite at times.
I met someone the other day who thought it was brilliant. They loved it. They thought it was amazing.
I don't know why.
Had they never seen a film before, I thought to myself.
Well, there's no accounting for taste, Jason.
Puss in Boots, Zan. Tell me, this is the spin-off, I presume, from Shrek. This is Antonio Banderas' character, and I like him in the Shrek films. And here he is. He's got an idea for a heist that would leave him with wealth beyond his wildest dreams.
The murderous outlaws Jack and Jill have gotten their hands on magic beans.
Do not joke with me about magic beans. I search half my life for them. They do not exist.
No, Cat. We have seen them.
These are the beans of legend.
Grosse fine to the land of giants and the golden goose.
The golden goose? A heist like this could set you up for life.
All nine of them. Show him the golden eggs.
Does he work? Does he deserve his own series, Puss?
Yeah, he does. I like, you know, Puss in Boots was the kind of saving grace, I think, of the last two.
He certainly
three
was, yeah,
Shrek
absolutely.
Films.
Yeah.
And so he certainly merits it. And this I found really rather entertaining. It's Puss in search of magic beans. He gets bewitched by Kitty the cat burglar, who's voiced by Salma Hayek. He gets undone by the evil Humpty Dumpty.
Wow, well, those two back again. Antonio Banderas and Sam Hayek were together in the remake of El Mariachi, weren't they?
They were, yeah, yeah. Desperado.
Yeah.
And this is weird because it is kind of a Desperado style of film. It's a spaghetti western tour through fairy tale conventions.
So is it kind of channeling the kind of fairy tale riffs that the first Shrek did that made
it
that
does.
So kind of
yeah,
appealing?
Yeah, it does. So it's got Humpty Dumpty, it's got Jack and Jill who are configured here as a pair of sort of ogre-ish brigands. And also it plays with a lot of Latino stereotypes. There is the sort of mariachi score, the Sergio Leone. It tips its hat to Sergio right. Leone films. It's got a flamenco standoff, a right. flamenco duel in there. It's perfectly enjoyable.
Is it better than Happy Feet 2?
It's better than Happy Feet 2, and I worry that it may well be the best film of the week.
But I that would be all right. I do like Antonio Banderas. I think he's quite a good.
He's brilliant, and it's certainly a change of pace from the skin that I live in.
My favourite, line I've liked in the most recent Shrek is where Antonio Banderas' puss says to the donkey, "Can I shave him?" At one point, just randomly.
He's a good character, Puss in Boots, because on the one hand he is the swashbuckling adventurer, but on the other hand he is. He's the cat who scratches things and runs after shiny objects and is completely easily distractible.
As swashbuckling household pets go, is he better than Dog Tanyan?
Dog Tanyan I haven't seen since I was a teenager, I don't think. I used to watch it avidly as a teenager. I was a very retarded teenager. I used to sit there in my shorts, sucking my lollipop, watching Dog Tanyan. And I remember enjoying it rather a lot. A great hulking brute of a 16-year-old.
Good. Puss in Boots, we give the thumbs up to Puss in Boots, if we're
do.
Allowed to do that. Can I tell you about The Well Digger's Daughter?
Yeah, that sounds
La
fun
fille
as well.
Du Puisatier. This is Daniel Auteuil back in bucolic south of France. Here is his daughter Patricia, played by Catalan-born jeans model Astrid Berges Frisbee. I kid you not, that really is her name. She's telling her dad that she is enceinte, pregnant.
Je l'ai vu deux fois.
Tu l'as vu deux fois et tu dis que tu l'as aimé? Mais moi, ta mère, je l'ai regardée pendant 5 ans avant de savoir que je l'aimais. Mais c'est vrai qu'aujourd'hui, avec le progrès, ça va plus vite. Hein. Qui est-ce?
C'est Jacques Mazel, le fils du bazar.
Classic Pagnol world, this is. Of course, Daniel Auteuil came to the fore playing in the Jean de Florette Manon des Sources double bill 25 years ago.
Wow.
I think he's established himself now as kind of one of the leading French actors of all time, really.
I think he probably has, yeah.
And here he's directing for the first time. Unfussily, I like to see. He doesn't go all flash. He's kind of plonk the camera there and let the scenery and the characters do the talking. It's a remake of a 1940 Pagnol film and it's in the first place, which was a very long, kind of hard scrabble social realist look at the kind of life of peasants. Prince, played by Fernandel and Raymu, a sort of a legendary double bill there. And this sort of is a bit more, it's pretty. It's kind of slightly lost something along the way. I'm not sure we're that interested anymore in the kind of life of Provençal peasants. I think it must be very difficult to make this kind of film now, but find a Provence that hasn't got kind of, you know...
British tourists, second homes.
Wine refineries all over the place. But he seems to have managed it quite well. He's got one of those thick accents, even thicker waistline. He's rather good in it, playing Amoretti, the well digger. And of course, the daughter then gets pregnant, so she's ruined in his eyes. And it was very odd because, I mean, he's so kind of intransigent. You are ruined. I can't talk to you. I don't talk to my daughter anymore. I'm going to banish her. And just thinking, well, you know, these days, would we be so annoyed by such things? And so it looks a bit out of place, but she has this kind of long-standing kind of pregnancy with Jacques, the airman, played by Nicolas Duvauchel, who always plays a sort of feckless young man. He was the son in, Claire Denis' son in White Material recently.
Oh, yeah.
And he's always a bit of madness about him. Mm. And so he goes off to war, the Second World War, and he leaves her destitute and ruined. And then, of course, it being a Pagnol saga, this kind of seed that he's planted comes back much, much later. I quite liked it.
Okay.
It was kind of nice. It's not brilliant in any way, but it's very watchable. And I gather that it did quite well in France, and Auteuil is now making and directing and starring in two more Pagnol remakes.
Really?
Marius.
Well Digger's granddaughter?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me because we've had the Gloire de mon père, Chateau de ma mère, de ma tante, and all of those great Pagnol books are being made into films. But this really wasn't bad if you like that sort of thing. We have one more film to tick off on a festive theme as well. It's called New Year's Eve, directed by Gary Pretty Woman Marshall and starring Jessica Biel, Hilary Swank, Michelle Pfeiffer, Robert De Niro, Common, Ashton Kutcher, Leah Michelle, basically everyone, an advent calendar of hello people.
You know what? I don't care about all that hoopla and stuff anyway.
So no big plans, a party, or no hot days, pretty girl like you.
Well, maybe. Right now, you're my hot date.
Why?
Pardon me?
Why would you want to be nice to me? I'm an ass. Spent my entire life being an ass. I don't know how to stop.
Well, you know what, Stan? Maybe being an ass is the reason you've gotten every single thing you ever wanted in life.
Not everything.
New Year's Eve was brought to you by the people who gave us Valentine's Day
last year.
Yeah. So successful was that they thought they'd do it again with another kind of yearly event. Does it work?
Well, it's got the ticking time code, hasn't it? Which makes it look like an old school disaster movie.
What, the race against the clock?
The race against the clock, the all-star cast. But what they're racing up to is the dropping of the ball drop of New Year's Eve. They probably should have called this
as a 16-year-old.
Yeah, should have called this ball drop, shouldn't they? That would have been fun. And you've got all the intersecting lives, and there are connections here that maybe we don't know about, but it'll turn out that these characters know each other more than we think they do.
Should we explain for our non-US resident listeners that the ball drop is what happens in Times Square every midnight? Yeah. I think a big glittery ball seems to drop down on the countdown to midnight.
Yeah.
It's a big deal, apparently.
It is, and they always have the prior of the year underneath the ball to get squashed. It's New York tradition.
That would be great, wouldn't it?
It would. I'd like to put some of the cast under
most
that.
Most of it, all of them, and the director.
It's sort of Magnolia on Prozac for morons, isn't it?
Is it the worst film ever made?
It's one of them. I almost think it's not a film. It's a hydra-headed beast of corporate evil,
isn't it? Because the product placement is egregious.
Everywhere. And it's a lifestyle commercial in the guise of a festive film. Full of product placement, full of absolutely empty, vapid characters.
And John Bon Jovi singing.
And John Bon Jovi, who's obviously there for the youth kind of audience, isn't he?
It's a film made by Gary Marshall, who I gather met his wife, or proposed to his wife on New Year's Eve 50 years ago.
Wow, isn't that lovely?
And I think this is a film made by a man... Underneath the ball. And I think this is a film made by a man who hasn't been to New Year's Eve in Times Square since 1952, because it just feels so old-fashioned. All the black characters, they're like...
Yeah, they're shoeshine boys, basically.
Shoeshine boys. It's clearly a man who never wants to go to Times Square on New Year's Eve because he couldn't think of anything worse to do, but is making a film about it because he thinks people want to go to Times Square on New Year's Eve, where, of course, it looks awful.
I'm not even sure it's got that much reasoning behind it, apart from we've got all these people, let's just sort of film them and use it as an excuse to sort of plug some merchandise. I feel very churlish now criticising Martin Scorsese for making Hugo last week, because then you see De Niro in this playing the sort of soulful dying man in the hospital bed, and you think, why? What on earth? He doesn't need the money.
No,
what
he
on earth
doesn't.
Is he doing?
I often always defend people because we say that about actors. We say, well, why would they do this? And we say it's because actors, they like to work, you know. If they
so there was nothing else on the table, working. Yeah? There's no other scripts.
But De Niro really doesn't need to work, and there's surely something he could do, like get some more funding for the Tribeca Film Festival,
yeah, why not?
Or something that better than this.
Yeah.
And Michelle Pfeiffer as well.
Michelle Pfeiffer. Catherine Hagel is terrible in it.
Yeah, Catherine Hagel. Looks
she's
like
in
she,
charge of the ball, isn't she?
She plays... that's Hilary Swank. She's in charge
of the ball. Oh, she's in charge of the ball.
They all
itself. Blur.
Catherine Hagel is catering the party.
Catering, yeah, that's
which
right.
is the party that everyone wants to go to, but yet looks terrible.
Yeah.
And she's a chef catering it, and she looks like she's... If I'm honest, she's been at a lot of pies. She ain't fitting into any of those 27 dresses that she was talking about 2 years ago.
No, she ain't.
Because now it's all gone. I'm sorry.
Is this going to be like a franchise? Are they going to do Easter next, where
Easter
Catherine
Bunny?
Hagel gets nailed to the cross, perhaps, and De Niro kisses Zac Efron? I'll watch
fashion.
That one.
Yeah, that would be lovely. Because there's outtakes at the end of this, which are clearly not
staged.
Outtakes.
Yeah, they're utterly staged, aren't they?
In the way that there are outtakes at the end of Shrek, which are kind of obviously staged because
they have to animate them. Yeah, they can't really do it live, can they? So, it's a terrible strain on the animator's hands.
And there's a scene because there's two women who are fighting to give birth, like the first baby on New Year's Eve. And what they do is they give birth. There's a shot that she's given birth to two DVDs, a DVD and a Blu-ray of Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
The film that preceded this.
Yeah.
That's the worst bit of product placement you can possibly do.
There's the absolute stench of sulphur about this film.
Well, there's other product placement as well, isn't there? There's a big advert for Sherlock Holmes starring Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, which is the same studio.
But Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
This is the greatest movie ever
Happy
sold.
Happy Christmas,
this is the worst
suckers.
Movie ever sold. Zan, you're going to stay to help me round up some of the week's awards, because the awards season began in earnest and you and I were there. But for breaking film news and reviews at any time of day or night, just go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film.
This is not why we make films. We don't do films to get this.
Deshalb machen wir keine Filme, um so einen Preis zu bekommen. Aber
now that was a Danish actor accepting his award in perfect English, but overdubbed by German. It was Mads Mikkelsen picking up the European Achievement in World Cinema Award at that Euro mashup that is the European Film Awards, the EFAs. This year it took place in Berlin, as I mentioned earlier. Zan and myself were there. Willkommen, Zan. Did you enjoy the EFAs?
I always enjoy the EFAs. It's in a different city every year. We've done Copenhagen. We did Tallinn last year.
Next year?
Next year, Malta.
Malta.
Sunny Malta. It's a strange event. It's colourful and a bit chaotic.
I kind of support it, though.
I support it.
Why
do we support it? Because I think European film is important, and the EFAs are a good antidote to the Hollywood-dominated Oscars.
They're almost... like a deliberate antidote.
Yeah, they
Oscars,
are a deliberate
antidote.
I mean, for instance, this year we do have a genuine European contender at the Oscars in the form of The Artist, and yet The Artist here just won an award for its score.
Yes, he was very excited, Ludovic.
Very excited, but you'd expect it to maybe get a little bit more.
So I mean, that would have been exciting had The Artist won here, and then it would have been like, off you go. We've rewarded you in Europe. Off you go now and kind of go get him at the Oscars.
It seems very schizoid in terms of the spread of awards. There was, you know, Colin Firth won for The King's Speech a full, you know, 10 months after he won his Oscar. Tilda Swinton won Best Actress for We Need to Talk About Kevin, which is entirely deserved. And Best Film went to Melancholia by Lars von Trier.
Who wasn't there?
Who wasn't there, of course, because of the fallout from Cannes, and he's not making any more public appearances, poor old Lars. So he sent his wife in instead.
Who said he's not going to make any public appearances, because apparently she was very upset with what happened to him, obviously.
Yeah.
His wife, who seems a very pleasant woman.
Yeah, she did, so, yeah.
Met her afterwards.
And as you said, that's probably the main story of the EFAs, yeah. Is, you know, Lars von Trier's wife seems nice. Shock.
Poor her. that film sort of sit very... seemed to be very well received in Europe. It didn't do that well here in the UK.
No.
It did quite well in America. I gather that it came second to The Artist in the New York Critics Circle votes.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Okay.
But I was surprised that it nearly swept the board. It looked like had it been allowed to sweep the board, it would have, because it won for cinematography as well, Manuel Alberto Claro as well. Mm. So I think it was very highly rated over there and well received. There were many Danes about.
They seemed to, last year they dumped the bulk of their awards on Polanski, and there was a sense that the European Film Academy gets behind the auteur who's in a bit of trouble, in a spot of hot water, and shows solidarity. Having said that, they also gave the Best Director Award to Suzanne Bier, fellow Dane, but the woman who sparked the Nazi conflagration in Cannes.
But then it was really weird because Mads Mikkelsen had worked with Suzanne Bier, so he was giving her a big hug. He's obviously worked with von Trier as well. Stellan Skarsgård, who's often von Trier's male muse, he was giving the prize to Mads Mikkelsen.
Yes.
It shows how sort of what a tinderbox and how small that Danish film community is, and yet how successful.
Well, also, it shows the whole awards show how small Europe is in a way, in that it's what's nice about those awards is that it's very convivial, it's very democratic. Even, you know, idiots like us are allowed to wander around and shake hands and have a chat and have a drink with the great and the good. And that makes it very different from the Oscars, which I've never been to. But I suspect part of the reason I've never been to is because they don't want me there.
And I don't think they'd allow you to sort of sit there looking at Ludivine Seignier and Jean Dujardin.
We had an Attack of the Schoolboy Giggles, I think, at the actual ceremony because of the slight cultural differences in the language barriers, where one of the presenters was solemnly extolling the virtues of the Turin horse and says it plays out mostly in silence, accompanied only by the sound of violent wind. And I must admit, I was thinking I was going to have to excuse myself for a bit at that point.
You were so taken with that, you even filed that.
I think I tweeted it.
As part of your news roundup. Fart gag at European Film
Awards. You know, you have to lower the tone somehow.
No, we enjoyed it very much. But I do support them because I think it's a good thing. I wish that people covered it more in this country. We don't seem to take the feed. 37 countries take it. They present it in English.
Yeah.
And yet no, which is everyone's second language. So there's that stilted kind of humour.
Yeah, they're giving us a lot of concessions and yet we're still beguiled
by
Hollywood.
We're the least European of all those people. Even though it was a big night for Brits, as you're Stephen Frears, a Lifetime Achievement Award, and Terry Gilliam, with whom I had breakfast the next morning, rather surprisingly, won for what looked like a pasta commercial of a short film.
Yeah, we're talking about New Year's Eve being a commercial, but I think The Holy Family, which is a little fantasy set in Naples, was it sort of part funded by a pasta company?
It was.
And I haven't seen it, but the clip they showed was very heavy on the pasta.
We go, spaghetti. But anyway, Terry Gilliam. Career looks to be going well. His short film will maybe blossom into a long career of feature films. That was the European Film Awards, but they weren't the first awards of that. They were the first awards of that weekend, but they're not the first awards of the season because the Biffers came along as well the night after. I hot-footed it back from Berlin to make it to Old Billingsgate Market, where I saw Paddy Considine collecting the Best Debut Prize for his film Tyrannosaur, which is, in fact, swept the board as much as a film like that can sweep, with Olivia Colman winning, I think very deservedly, the Best Actress as well.
I thought this was a great film. The advance word on it was that it was the same old social realist, hard, it's hard up north, wife batterers, drunks. And it is all that, and yet it is superbly acted, particularly by the three people at the centre, by Eddie Marzan, by Peter Mullen, and obviously Olivia Colman. So this was a heartening choice. Didn't the King's Speech win?
Well, last year I was on the jury, and the King's Speech was sort of sweeping the board there. And I kind of almost tendered my resignation because I thought this wasn't a film that needed Biffa's help. This year they had a film, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which I think is a magnificent film, which was up for Biffa's, but it seems to have been shut out. It won for production design.
That's
and it
surprising
seems to have sort of,
because
as a response to the King's Speech kind of being a kind of almost high budget, low budget film, if you see.
Yeah, I guess it was a reaction to it to last year. I mean, if, you know, maybe this shows my conservative credentials, I think that probably Tinker Tailor is a better film than Tyrannosaur, but not significantly better, and I was very happy to see Tyrannosaur win because
I've got no
problem
with
it. These kind of films that do need the push.
And Lynn Ramsey got Best Director. Yep. I was pleased to see women. I think I tweeted this. Women seem to be doing very well at the Biffers, much better than they are in Sports Personality of the Year.
Yeah, and Michael Fassbender winning for Shame, which again is thoroughly deserved.
Yeah, this is happening. I mean, Gary Oldman, who I thought would be kind of, you know, awards shoe in for his Smiley, he seems to be being beaten left, right, and centre by Michael Fassbender.
It's a little bit depressing if you look at it one way, because Oldman's performance is very much part of an ensemble. It's deliberately low down in the mix. Mm. It's not a performance that calls attention to itself. He's a spy.
Other than therefore being a low profile, Gary Oldman performance, because normally he is so
normally
big.
He's extrovert, and this time he's very much introvert. But I still don't have any problems with Fassbender winning. I mean, you know, Shame is an astonishing film, and he gives a brilliant performance in it.
So the Biffers, I thought, was quite a good ceremony. Chris O'Dowd kind of clipped it along at a good old pace.
Yeah, I heard that.
And I enjoyed it. So I think it's indicative of maybe of what award seasons to come, although there was no, of course, Meryl Streep in there, and Tilda Swinton didn't win for Best Actress there.
No.
So things will change over the course.
Who
but not
knows
by much.
How it's going to change? The only shoo-in at this early stage, at the moment, the theoretical shoo-in, is Meryl Streep for Best Actress for The Iron Lady. Everything else seems very much up for grabs.
I'm going back to the ethos.
Yeah,
I'm still going for
right.
the artist for
yeah.
Best Picture. Although I keep looking at the artist now and it keeps showing it in these awards ceremonies and they keep showing clips of the artist. And I think I mentioned this to you at the ethos. Every time they show a clip of someone doing a bit of mugging or a silent film and everyone says, well, it's a silent film. It just looks a little odd to me. It just looks not funny. And
in isolation, the artist looks bad.
Yeah.
But taken as a whole, it's sublime.
That's what I think. So we will be talking to the director, Michel Hazanavicius, of The Artist on this show shortly. And I think I'm meeting Jean Dujardin and Bérénice Bejo for a little dance for an interview with The Observer on Friday. So I shall tell them.
Does dancing come out well in print?
Dancing looks brilliant in print. Much better than it does, I assure you, in real life, the way I do it. Zan, lovely to spend all these awards with you. I look forward to spending some more.
Thank you, Jase.
And all that sycophantic awards applause brings us to a close on Film Weekly this week. But we are asking you for your thoughts on what were your top three films of 2011, your own personal award winners that will be fed into our Film Weekly end of year treat, our top 10 films roundup between me and Zan that we'll be broadcasting on New Year's Eve. But we want you to take part too. Please message us on Facebook. That's Facebook.com/Film Weekly. Your top three films of 2011. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is the refined score to The Well Digger's Daughter by that ubiquitous French composer Alexandre Desplat. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.